This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everybody. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here at the People Speak, we believe when the people speak, they do make a difference. You can listen to us live on BBS Radio every Tuesday and Wednesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our website at www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to our past shows on our iPod Ready Archive section. That's www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. And you can also listen to us live via satellite on your Nokia phones. Just go to the website for details. I'm really thrilled tonight. Our guest tonight is a young man that I've long admired in his career, and his life has proved the odds wrong, have proved the myths a lie, and have shown that even in war, there can still be the possibility for peace. Adam, your documentary that I was privileged to see part of at the showing the other day in Michigan in Livonia is about love, as far as I could tell. It's about the love for family, a love for country, and a love for dignity. Adam is here tonight from the streets of New York to talk to us about his experiences in the Middle East and about his latest documentary, The Chronicles of a Refugee. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Thank you so much for having me, Basma.
It's a pleasure. Adam, the first time I met you was, probably about three? Well, how long have you and Hawaii been married? Because that was the year that I met you.
It's now 6 years.
Wow, it doesn't seem like that long. The first time I met Adam was in Troy, Michigan. They were doing a demonstration, and I wanted to take my grandsons to. Actually, that was their first demonstration. Adam, and you were only about three miles from their home, so I figured, wow, this is a perfect opportunity. I'm very proud that it was you and your wife, your lovely wife, Hawaida. How is Hawaida?
She's doing very good. She's currently in Palestine. And she's doing well.
Wonderful. Please give her my best when you see her. I'm really thrilled to have met both of you. Adam, before we talk about the film, there are a few things that, of course, we'd like to touch on you. For those of you that are not familiar with Adam and his work and his life, you were originally with Seeds of Peace during the time of the siege of Chairman Arafat's compound. And you generated a lot of controversy by going in to the compound itself to help extradite some of the injured that were lingering in there, and you ended up being the victim of not only being shot at by Israeli IDF at the time of the compound siege, but your family and yourselves were harassed later on. Can you tell us kind of basically what the events of that were?
Well, by the time the really got underway, I had already left Seeds of Peace, and Kuwait and I and others had started the International Solidarity Movement, which I'm sure some of your listeners are probably familiar with. And at the time of the invasions of the spring of 2002, at the very end of March 2002, the first place that the Israeli army came was Ramallah, and the first place in Ramallah they went to was President Arafat's compound. During that day, I was riding on an ambulance to try to help sick and injured people in the sea. In the end, we also had to move people who were killed by the invading army. And by the end of the day, after riding on the ambulance the whole day, we were called to come to the compound to try to bring out some of the people who had been shot, who were inside, and to try to get them out to safety. I went with the ambulance. I negotiated with Israeli soldiers for 3 hours, because, of course, the compound was completely surrounded. and there was no way to bring an ambulance in just without their permission, essentially. And eventually they gave it, and I'm not sure why, and looking back now, I really don't understand how that happened, is that they agreed to let me in. In the end, they let me in, and then wouldn't let me out, and neither I nor the injured people or whatnot. Eventually, we did get out. We did bring other internationals at that point in to make a bigger stand, and we also had internationals and others in the other cities, in Bethlehem and Jenin and Nablus and whatever, during all of the other invasions of the other cities.
So, Adam, you were actually had already started the ISM, the International Solidarity Movement, by that time?
Yes, by that time the ISM had already conducted, I think, probably two campaigns, and we were planning for our third at that point. So we had pretty been well established and had hundreds of volunteers come and join the ISM by that point. And yes, like you said, as a result of being in the compound, I was approached and did a number of media interviews, not just on that day and the day after, but for the next couple of weeks. We took journalists around as we did our work as the ISM. And as a result of that, my family came under intense criticism, is to be kind. In the U.S., especially in New York City, they received threats, they received sense of harassment, but that didn't last beyond, you know, the time that I was in the media. I mean, every now and then something comes out on the Internet about me, but for the most part, it's okay.
Yeah, I saw it. I couldn't help but notice it as I was doing some research. I see you... I see you've got a great sense of humor about it, and that's wonderful. I guess you really have to have a sense of humor when you're dealing with the type of work that you do. What was Chairman President Arafat like? You had breakfast with him, and that was one of the biggest things that infuriated people, is that you actually had a social connection at that point with the president.
Socialist, to go, I think, is a little bit beyond what it really was.
You were socializing under siege.
Yeah, it was more like a hard-boiled egg. But, of course, the journalists like this kind of stuff, and they play it up. But, yes, we did share food. He was grateful to me for coming in to try to help. He was very appreciative. It was a time of great strain for him, for all of the people in the compounds. It was a time of great danger. We didn't spend that much time together. We did speak a little bit. He wanted to know from me what was going on outside. He wasn't in communication with a lot of people outside, and so I was able to provide some information, what I had known up until that point. It wasn't, however, the first time I had met Chairman Arafat or President Arafat. I had met him a few times before that, so he knew me somewhat, and I knew him, and overall it was clearly The overall impact of the Intifada, the whole time since the breakdown of the Camp David talks, had worn on him tremendously, and the stress and strain of trying to do something to achieve independence and liberty and justice for his people over all of these years had clearly worn on him, and he was nowhere near, obviously, the figure that he had previously been and that we can read about and in archival footage and all. But he was still, I think, an impressive man at that time, and he did one extraordinary thing which I thought was truly remarkable. At the height of Israeli fire on the compound that night and the next morning, he came downstairs. He was upstairs, and he came downstairs where most of the men were, and he literally walked around and shook everybody's hand and asked everybody in the compound about their families and about where they were from and about their wives or children or mothers or whatever. And it was just an incredible human gesture at that moment to sort of give confidence to people who are much younger than him, who hadn't been through the battles that he had been through. And it was truly a remarkable moment, and it was something I'll never forget.
Well, you remind me of the charisma that President Arafat had, the ability to be humble, the ability to come down with his people. Adam, this is not your first documentary. You were involved in a documentary called About Baghdad and the Darfur Diaries. Is there some kind of a similarity, or is this, what did you have in mind when you went through selecting the three documentaries that you are currently involved with?
It was a little bit different motivation, although I think the general theme of basically what I see as my position, which is that I have the opportunity, or I create the opportunities and the privilege to be able to go to these places and what's going on in these places of conflict. I really feel what I can do best with that privilege and that opportunity is provide an opportunity for people who don't get to have their voices heard to have them, you know, put out there in some way. And of course, in filmmaking, you always edit, and you always have to, when you're editing, you're always imposing your will in some regard on what people are saying and on their interviews. But nonetheless, I feel that's something that I can do and an opportunity that I think is important to utilize. With the Iraq film in particular, we were very interested in combating the simplified and oversimplified way that the U.S. media was portraying the war in Iraq. And so the film about Baghdad that we did was very much an attempt to bring Iraqi voices into the American consciousness. And that film was made now 5 years ago, and unfortunately, and I say it unfortunately, that film is still relevant today in many ways, and I've had people come up to me and say they just recently watched About Baghdad, and if only American officials had watched the film back in 2003 and listened to the Iraqis, we may not be in the mess we're in today. With the Darfur film, what we tried to do with that film was we're the first people to go into Darfur, my colleagues and I, and make a documentary. And what we tried to do there was expose. We didn't buy into this whole Arab versus African dynamic that has gotten a lot of attention and press here in the United States. Instead, we realized that this was really the effort of a government to essentially divide its own people against each other and to use whatever resources it had at disposal, in this case, the ethnic card, to try to pit people against each other in order to extend the government's, sort of iron rule, which was based on discrimination and based on sort of hoarding resources of the country for only certain groups and excluding others. And that's what that film tried to do. And it's funny, but you would think making a film about Darfur would at least make me more palatable to those in the pro-Israel or Zionist movement in this country, but actually quite the opposite. I'm a dissident within the Darfur movement as well, because I don't buy into the bad Arab idea of the conflict.
So you don't believe that every Muslim is a terrorist hiding under some bed ready to pounce on you and clothe your wife in a hijab?
Well, if that was the case, I would have been pounced on a lot already. I've lived in too many Muslim countries, and certainly that is not the case. But.
Absolutely. The Chronicles of a Refugee. That mm-hmm. is, now, the other night when I was invited to the opening of that here in Livonia, and it was an unbelievable oral history of a people. One thing I have to tell you, I was a little bit surprised that you had done it in Arabic. Why is that, Adam? Why did you choose Arabic?
Well, we did it in Arabic primarily for two reasons. One, obviously, this is the language that Palestinians share in common no matter where they are. And we filmed in over 15 countries around the world, some in the Middle East, some in Europe, in the United States, and elsewhere. And this, of course, is the language that Palestinians, is their national language, although obviously some in the younger generations who've grown up in the West don't necessarily speak it as well, or in some cases at all. So they do speak English in the movie. But more importantly, we're making this series primarily for the Palestinian and Arab audiences, those who are in the Middle East and those who are in the diaspora around the world. And as such, we wanted this to be in the language that in which expression is most comfortably made. And even with translation, even with subtitles, you can't always capture the full meaning of the Arabic language because it is a very rich and dynamic language that oftentimes English doesn't quite capture.
Let me add, we're going to open it up to some questions in a couple of minutes. I do want to touch on exactly how the Chronicles of a Refugee was planned out. This is not a one-part series. This is a one-part documentary. This is a series. And right. What is the rationale behind the series, and can you explain a little bit about the parts of the documentary and how you're going about to presenting them?
Sure. You're right. It's a six-part series. We chose this part because this is the 60th anniversary of the Nakba of 1948, which led to the dispossession of Palestinians of their homelands and their homes. And so that's why we chose six parts. Also, we were quite certain that we had enough issues and subjects to cover in to really justify having so many parts of a series. And to really explore in depth these issues. Part one deals specifically with 1948 and is wholly the testimony of those people who lived through the events of 1948 and experienced 1948 and offers insight into what life was like both before the Nakba, during the Nakba, and then immediately after in terms of how these new refugees were received in the countries they went to, how they were treated, and what kind of conditions they faced after living their lives in their homeland. And so it's looking at that. Part two then looks at what have been the other explosions that Palestinians have experienced over the years, because, of course, 1948 is the most important and the biggest in many numbers, certainly, in terms of impact on a community. But it's not the only time Palestinians have been expelled from countries or from refugee camps simply because they're Palestinians. And we felt it was really important to look at these other expulsions coming out of the Nakba and then on to outside the Arab world as a way of showing what has been the refugee experience, what has been the Palestinian refugee experience. One is as a means of educating and making aware for all Palestinians of what has been the collective Palestinian experience. And then secondly, to build this consciousness of a collective experience so that we can then devise strategies as a collective moving forward. Part three is also in that sort of vein of developing a consciousness of the collective experience, but here in part three we're looking at discrimination, official discrimination by government, by international agencies against Palestinians because they are Palestinians, because they are a stateless people, because they are refugees.
What do you mean by experiencing discrimination around the world?
Discrimination takes different forms in different countries. In Jordan, Palestinians do enjoy citizenship. However, there are certain areas of discrimination that they do face. There are positions in the government, for instance, that are barred to Palestinians. But more importantly and more significantly in terms of the overall community, for instance, the Palestinian flag today is not allowed to be flown in Jordan. You're not allowed to display the Palestinian flag in public. So there is a sort of discrimination officially against Palestinian identity in Jordan, the expression of public identity as Palestinians in Jordan, which is very different than the experience in Lebanon, where the expression of Palestinian identity in a public way is encouraged in many ways in Lebanon. However, in Lebanon, there is official discrimination in other areas, such as there's a list of, I forget exactly how many, but over 50 professions in which Palestinians are officially barred from working in. So it takes different forms, this discrimination, in different places. In Europe, after Munich, for instance, after the Black September operations at the Munich Olympics. Many Palestinians who were studying in Europe, who were living in Europe in different countries, had their visas canceled, were forced out of the country, were deported from different countries, simply because they were Palestinian. These are people who were not involved at all with with the hijackings that happened subsequently or with events in Munich themselves, but they were targeted simply because they were Palestinian. And then, of course, we have the United States, where specifically after 9/11, and most notably in the case of Dr. Sami Al-Aryan, Palestinians have been targeted because they are Palestinian, because they advocate on Palestine in the United States. Although it didn't start really with 9/11. We know of the case of the LA 8, Michelle Shahada and others, who were targeted for the work that they were trying to do advocating for Palestinian rights as early as the 1970s. And there was an attempt to deport them and of course, discrimination against them. So we have different kinds of discrimination, official, but in many different places around the world. And this is a common experience. And it shapes how Palestinians think about their own future and their own strategies and whatever. Parts 4, 5, and 6 then get into more strategy subjects. Part 4, looking at specifically the question of identity and what aspects of identity are how identity is formed, whether Palestinian refugees should live in camps or outside of camps, what the usefulness of camps 50, 60 years after the Nakba. We look at the issue of citizenship both inside the Arab world, outside the Arab world, kinds of subjects. Part 5 looks at specifically the right of return, and we're looking at it not from the principled position of international law and whatnot. We're looking at it more from the perspective of what are strategies that can be developed to try to implement to achieve right of return and other rights that Palestinians by wherever they are. And then part 6, finally, is about leadership and representation, and looking specifically at the relationship between the represented and the representative. And in no way are we advocating or calling for one faction or another faction vis-a-vis other factions. In no way are we saying that there should be a PLO or shouldn't be a PLO. In fact, what we heard from people around the world, Palestinians around the world, is that they want the PLO. They want an institution that represents them. They don't feel represented by the current PLO and haven't for quite a while. So the question is, some say it's a question of reform, but I think it's deeper than a question of reform. We have to examine what kind of leadership Palestinians want, how to make that happen, and what should be the responsibility of the representatives to those that they represent.
Well, this is a very well thought out and well planned out documentary. I applaud you. I mean, it is really a large task. Mike in California, we have email questions, and for those of you that would like to speak to our guest Adam Shapiro, you can call our toll-free numbers in the U.S. and Canada at 888-228-4494 or 877-489-6350. Once again, 888-228-4494 and 877-489-6350. We have a couple of email questions, Adam, for you from our listeners. I'm going to ask them a little bit backwards because the first one has to do with the documentary. Mike in California wants to know, as your 6-part documentary unfolds, do you think it will face a lot of reaction from pro-Israeli supporters, especially the later episodes?
I think it's inevitable that there'll be reaction from pro-Israel supporters. Quite frankly, I don't really care what they think. It's not the purpose of this documentary. They'll make of it what they want to make of it. I can easily see somebody who's pro-Israeli, pro-Zionist, whatever, watching the episode that we do on, for instance, leadership and representation and coming away saying, you see, the Palestinians, like, they can't get their own act together and yet we get blamed for the fact that they can't get their act together. And that's an opinion, and they might feel justified in saying that. I don't really care. What I care is that a Palestinian watching this, a young Palestinian, older Palestinian, anybody watching this, says, this is what our history has been until now. This is what our people want and what we feel we need. How do we make that happen? And that, to me, is what's more important. And, again, we didn't make this film to convince pro-Zionists that they're wrong. We didn't make this film to convince pro-Israeli people that they're wrong. We made this film to look internally, to understand what has been the Palestinian collective experience, and to start making changes internally, because I don't think it's a leap to say that the internal Palestinian situation today is perhaps at its lowest point ever.
Yes, it is. And I'd like to take a question from Elaine from Iowa. She's been patient. Does Adam and his family feel safe now, considering it has been several years since his publicized visit to Arafat?
Yes, we feel totally safe. My parents are totally supportive of the work I do. My mom herself has been to Palestine as an activist and is very active here in New York City and outspoken. And if anything, I almost have to worry about the things she says now more than the things that I say.
that is wonderful. And please tell her that we are so proud to have you on our side. Another question, Ali from UK. Do Jews have the right to establish a country in the land of Palestine? And if they do, is it for religious or political reasons that they have this right? And if they don't have the right, what are the political or religious reasons for it? That's pretty lengthy, Ali.
It's pretty lengthy. I also think it really, not to be dismissive in any way, but I also think it almost doesn't matter. In the sense that Israel has used this argument about we have a right to do this and we have a right to do that as a means of deflecting from real issues. No, as far as I know, according to international law, no people has a right to establish a state based on anything. It, either you establish a state and by force or whatever other means, by consensual agreement or whatever, you manage to make it happen, or you don't. And as far as I know, in international law, and I'm fairly well versed in it, no state has the right to exist or not exist. There are other things about states that they have rights to do that certainly are founded upon in international law. But in terms of having a state on principle, it's really the history of mankind is just simply that it's a matter of usually force. And that's quite unfortunate. And what matters, I think, in this instance is not that Jews can justify the existence of the State of Israel based on religious beliefs or political realities, but because they have better strategies to make it happen. They had better strategies in 1948 to make it happen, and I think that can change. I think it's not out of the question. I think it's not impossible for Palestinians to develop a strategy and their supporters to develop a strategy whereby justice is achieved for Palestinians.
You know, you have a very, one of the things that, and I would like to add a little bit of what I believe is my insight on this issue of whether or not any state has the right to exist. And that's an interesting point you brought up. It's absolutely true, and I had never thought about that. But I think once the state is established, for whatever reasons, whether it has a right or doesn't have a right, it is under the obligation to adhere to the laws of mankind. And obviously, Israel has always stayed outside of the laws of mankind. And for my opinion, as far as I'm concerned, when people say things like, well, you just hate Jews. No, we don't. We don't hate Jews. All we're suggesting and saying is apply the law. Just like the law is applied in other areas of the world, just apply the law to Israel and we'll be satisfied. And I think that's the key. And I think that if you break it down to that simplicity, it has. I have a right to love or hate or dislike or embrace any society or any person or any entity on earth. This is my right as a human being. I don't have to love or hate anybody. what I have to abide by is the laws of mankind. And I think that as long as Israel is standing outside and violating the laws of society, which it clearly has, the United Nations has deemed it illegal in many settlements, the wall has been deemed illegal, all of these things have been deemed illegal, and Israel still thumbs its nose at the laws of mankind. My issue is apply the law. Once you've applied the law, then I am free to love or hate anybody that I choose. That's my decision. And as you said, it doesn't really matter whether I love or hate Israel. Just apply the law.
Exactly.
We have another question from, I believe it's Greg in Nebraska. Greg is asking, I have a question. Is the solidarity movement continue to demonstrate in Gaza against the Israeli demolition of homes?
No, unfortunately, because of Israel's closure policy on Gaza and the fact that Israel controls all entrances and exits to Gaza, it has been impossible to get ISM members into Gaza. And not just ISM, other organizations, other international organizations that are quote-unquote more respected than ISM also can't get their people into Gaza. Gaza is, for all intents and purposes, a prison, and not just for the people who are inside it, but for anybody who's trying to access Gaza as well. And so the unfortunate answer is no. But it should also be said that Israel is not... it's currently not pursuing a policy of demolishing homes in Gaza, with the exception of when it goes in with ground forces. And even then, its target isn't necessarily, you have to look at what they're doing militarily. They're not specifically going in to destroy homes. They're going in specifically to kill people and to wreak other kinds of damage. The policy of home demolitions that Israel carried out in Gaza over the years, which, of course, in one end ended up with the tragic killing of Rachel Corrie, murder of Rachel Corrie, that because the Israelis are no longer inside Gaza, isn't really being executed any longer. But people, ISF people, do stand in front of houses that are to be demolished in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, and we have not been deterred by the killing of Rachel Corrie in taking those down.
You are not able to get into Gaza, are you? You've tried on numerous occasions to get in there, haven't you, Adam?
Well, I'm not allowed any longer. It's been 6 years. I've been kicked out of Palestine and I can't get back in. I will be able to enter Gaza when the Egyptians and the Gazan Authority ends up making an arrangement to open one of the borders. I do have permission to enter once that happens. But until now, no, I have not been able to enter Gaza.
I see. We have a rebuttal from Ali in UK. I don't know if it's really a rebuttal. I think he's questioning your response. So Adam is saying Israel had the right to create the state, but not the way it was created.
No, nobody has the right to create a state. It's not a question of rights. The question of right only enters the discussion if you accept Israel's argument that it has a right to exist. Nobody else, no other country in the world makes the statement that it has a right to exist. I lived in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a country that was torn apart by civil war. It was invaded and occupied by the Soviet Union. Some argue that it was invaded and occupied by Pakistan via the Taliban regime. However, at no point when the Afghanis were fighting for liberation or when they were fighting in the civil war did you hear anybody say that the Afghan state had a right to exist. This is a discourse that only Israel uses. And unfortunately, it's a trap, because those of us who are pro-Palestinian end up getting caught up in an argument about what makes that right legitimate or not legitimate, and there's no way to have that argument because there's no standard by which to have it.
Thank you. We have another question. I hope that answered your question, Ali. I don't think Adam is advocating the right of Israel to exist one way or the other. I think that
I don't think it has a right to exist, and I don't think any state has a right to exist.
Not at the cost of the lives of the inhabitants of the state. We have a question from Christina from New Jersey. I work with youth, and I am curious, what is the most effective and safe way youth who are unable to go to Palestine to help out from the U.S.? And are there any films easily accessible to help educate inner-city Hispanic and African-American youth about Palestine? Adam's film.
In terms of the films, I would say a really great film that really helps explain things and does so from, sort of the ground up is Occupation 101, which is a wonderful film that a couple of friends of mine made. It's been out for, I think, about 2 years now. It's available on DVD. I know you could probably get it from Amazon. It's really a wonderful film and is certainly at the level where anybody from, I would say, high school on up can watch it and understand it and really grasp what's happened. And they do make connections and they do draw out sort of similarities between the struggle for justice in Palestine and other rights struggles, including the civil rights struggle in the U.S., the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, the independence movement in India, and others. So that's a really great film. In terms of what people can do here in the U.S., I can get out of that quite easily and say it's not my concern because I don't live in the U.S. anymore. Unfortunately, and I've said this before, I said this the other night at the screening, I truly do believe that just as the West Bank and Gaza are occupied territory, just as I also believe that 48 lands are also occupied territory, I also believe that Congress and in general our foreign policy systems are occupied territory. And there's a reason for it. Israel spends a lot of money. Israel has a lot of influence through various mechanisms, not just AIPAC, although AIPAC gets most of the credit. We also need to look at the defense industry in this country. We also need to look at the biomedical field and lobby in this country. We also need to look at the high-tech industry and lobbies in this country. All of them are very cozy with Israel. All of them benefit tremendously from U.S. policy towards Israel. And all of that pretty much has to be undone if there's going to be a change in U.S. policy towards Israel. Quite frankly, I don't think that's going to happen. So we have to find other means. And for me, one of those means is getting the Palestinian movement, national movement, better organized, more responsible to its own people, and more valuing of its own people in order to have a better national movement to achieve liberation. And I'm a dissident among activists here in the U.S. in the sense that I don't think it's worth too much really spending our time educating here in the U.S. Average people, certainly useful. Getting people to send money and support to Gaza and to other Palestinians who need that support is great. In terms of expecting political change, just look at our newest hope candidate who's talking about change in this country, Barack Obama. And all you have to do is go back, not that long ago, to speeches he used to make talking about how he understood the Palestinian situation and how the situation in the Middle East between Israelis and Palestinians in terms of the U.S. involvement was wrong, was a policy and all of that. And you just watched his speech. He just gave it AIPAC. And we've seen change now among Barack Obama. It's changed to understand that he shouldn't buck up against any systems that would get him elected president.
Absolutely. I think that in his most recent speech, that was not just a speech, that was an alliance that was being created between him and Israel, which was very disheartening. We have a caller online for Nina from Houston. Nina, do you have a question for Adam Shapiro?
Yes.
Nina, can you speak up a little bit? I can't hear you.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Adam, can you hear her?
I'm going to have you, I think you're going to have to repeat her question for me if you don't mind.
Okay, Nina, try to speak up a little bit and I'll try to relay the question.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, I just wanted to tell him that I listened to his, what he was saying, and he said that during the Olympic Games in Munich, Palestinians were denied visas. And I wanted to know that Germany is under a lot of pressure from Israel. A lot. We had no other choice. The people had no say-so in that. And I was in Germany at that time, and it was so critical.
Thank you, Nina. I will relay it. What Nina was saying is that during the you were talking about the Munich Olympics and the fact that the Palestinians were denied visas in Germany, and she's saying that we, and I'm going to assume that she's German because she said we, didn't have any choice, that Israel had put a lot of pressure on the Germans, and they had very little choice as to how the Palestinians were treated after that due to the fact that Israel was putting so much pressure on them.
I mean, that could very well be. I'm not trying to suggest that the German people are responsible for these kinds of decisions that its government made, but the fact of the matter is that the Palestinians who are living there ended up being kicked out. And, you know, some people did react some individual Germans did react in a very negative way. I met people who talked to me about how their landlords came to them without any government pressure and told them that they had to leave their apartment, because they were Palestinian, because they, you know, what happened at Munich convinced some Germans, not all, obviously, that Palestinians were all terrorists or suspected of, you know, terrorists, just like what happened here in the United States. Not all Americans ended up thinking all Muslims and Arabs were terrorists after 9/11, but some did, and some acted on that. So I hope that clarifies things.
Thank you. I think she was just trying to show you that it wasn't really just all of the Germans didn't really appreciate what was happening to the Palestinians at that time. I'd like to, you know, when we were at the filming, at the showing of the film, Adam, afterwards you had a Q&A, and you had mentioned that we had, and obviously you touched somewhat on the way Palestinians are treated in other countries. What about Iraq? How are the Palestinians treated in Iraq as far as trying to leave the Palestinian refugees? Are they able to leave Iraq?
No. The Palestinian refugees who've been in Iraq since 1948 and their descendants, all the years that they lived in Iraq, they were never granted passports by the Iraqi government, the successive Iraqi government. None of them granted the Palestinians passports. They had Palestinian refugee travel documents, which are not passports and which had to constantly be renewed. After 2003, Palestinians in Iraq came under tremendous pressure and violence and torture and kidnapping and killing. And it was targeting them specifically as Palestinians. Much has been made, of course, of the sectarian fighting in Iraq between Sunni and Shia and whatnot, and whether or not by that is, you know, in terms of that simplistic definition is one thing. But it's not because Palestinians are Sunni Muslims that they were targeted. They were targeted because they're Palestinian, because different groups in Iraq considered the Palestinians to have benefited from the Saddam Hussein regime, because Saddam very famously supported the Palestinian cause, at least vociferously, financially, and then, of course, in 1991 by firing Scud missiles towards Israel. However, the Palestinians inside Iraq did not benefit, except in very minor ways, and really actually nothing special as a result of Saddam's government. They actually had the same benefits issued to them by previous governments, which included subsidized or free housing and whatnot. However, in the post-Saddam era, in the chaos that is Iraq today and whatnot, it has become very easy for militias to target minority groups, and the Palestinians are a minority group there. They've tried to leave. Jordan and Syria have closed their borders to Palestinians of Iraq, and as well as other Arab countries, which they can't travel to anyway without a passport, and as has Turkey to the north. So Palestinians really are literally trapped in Iraq today, and they're also being targeted. The areas they live in Baghdad are essentially ghettos, and they need to get out, and I've been working actually to try to help get some of them out and find countries that would be willing to take these Palestinians. There are countries who would be willing to take some, but those countries need to make interviews with the refugees, and as long as they're stuck in Iraq, they can't be accessed. All of the Iraqis who have ended up in other countries as immigrants and fleeing Iraq have all gone to Jordan or Syria or some other country first in order to get interviewed and then processed and then out. That's just not possible for Palestinians who are in Iraq today.
Well, you've been kind enough to keep many of us activists, including myself, on your email list. And the last time I talked or heard from you, you were in one of the South American countries, I believe, helping some Palestinians get resituated there.
Yes, I was able to get Brazil and Chile to both accept a small number of Palestinians in both of those countries.
Well, that's big, though. Were they Iraqi Palestinians, or were they from other areas of diaspora?
No, Palestinians from Iraq. Those are the ones that I've specifically been working on.
Okay, I wasn't sure, because I know that you have dealt with so many Palestinians. You know, you've done how many, what is it, I think over 150 interviews with Palestinians in diaspora around the world?
Over 300, actually.
Really? Wow. If I had to tie you down and ask you which story impacted you the most out of all of them, could you relay one to us?
One story that obviously impacted us greatly was we met a woman who was about 106 years old. So basically in 1948, she was already a 40-something-year-old woman. And she was in Tantora, and she survived a massacre that occurred at Tantora and escaped with her children up to Syria and has lived in Syria ever since. And her memory is impeccable. I mean, she was telling us stories about the Ottoman period in Palestine, the pre-British times. and so her description of what life was like in Palestine before 48 was more vivid and more clear in so many ways than other people we met, because most of the other people we met who were alive in 1948 were either young children or a couple were, you know, maybe college age, but she was a grown woman. She had already lived, you know, 40 years of her life at that point, and so she really had quite distinct memories and could really describe in great detail what life was like, and she's really a remarkable woman.
Does she describe any of the times that the Palestinians embraced the Jews after their diaspora from Germany and Europe?
Tantora itself was a place that didn't really have Jews living in it, and so she, you know, being a woman at that time and raising a family, didn't have much exposure outside of her village. But it wasn't that Jews were seen as the enemy in any way at that time, and certainly she mentioned, you know, like, that there was an awareness that there were more Jews coming and more Jews coming, but, you know, nobody, you know, sort of in the villages really understood what was happening and what larger processes were underway. And so they really were caught in many ways by surprise by what happened.
I believe that, because even here, and I can tell from the frustration sometimes in your voice when you speak of American politics, we are being, many of our rights are being stripped. Look at America today. Habeas corpus is gone. The Patriot Act has the potential to suppress many people in this country. We advocate torture. We have warrantless searches, and people are still going about their business as if there was nothing going on. So I do understand that these things can kind of creep up on you. You know, when we hear our presidential candidate, such as Obama, making his statements and his alliances, what do you feel when you? I know you don't care, but as far as like the way it's being handled, but what do you feel when you hear those words come out, knowing the Palestinian experience as you do?
I mean, I guess it, you know, it just confirms what is expected, and it, you know, it shouldn't be. I guess it's not fair, perhaps, to make this sort of the standard by which you consider everything else that somebody like Obama would say or commitments that he's been making and whatnot. But it makes you question it in a way that, you know, all this talk about change, let's talk about doing things differently, you know. If there's pushback from other interest groups, you know, maybe he'll get pushed, and so it forces you to really question. Now, you know, John McCain is well known for his support for Israel for many years, and John McCain's father was involved in the cover-up of what happened to the USS Liberty in terms of the investigation into the attack on that ship by Israeli forces in 1967. So his connection and involvement with Israel is well known, and it goes back a very long time. So when John McCain says these things at AIPAC, of course it's not surprising. It's consistent with what he's been saying the whole time. To hear Barack Obama sound just like John McCain, or George Bush for that matter, when talking about what Americans I think would define and have consistently defined as the singular most important foreign policy issue over the years is making peace between Israelis and Palestinians. And how often do we have to hear presidents reiterate their commitment to this issue, often in the last year of their presidencies, and say how important this issue is to U.S. foreign policy in general, to Middle East politics in the region, and whatnot and whatnot, and yet they approach it consistently from the same point of view. And the same point of view isn't getting anybody anywhere, and quite frankly, is wrong.
Well, I have to agree with you. One of the things that we were just having a conversation earlier, and what I said was, people were saying, well, what is the solution? Well, the solution is to look at what you're doing, and if it isn't working, change it. If you look at the policies of the United States of America, they are not conducive to the enhancement of our social society, our civil society, our economic society. Nothing that we have done in the last few years or a couple of decades has improved the lot of American life. So if we continue doing these things, continue with the same alliances, continue with the same allegiances that we have, then we are going against our own best interest. How is that acceptable to Americans? I don't know, but obviously it has been. We reelected President Bush twice, after all. And so, and as far as the Israeli interests, I don't find it feasible for the Israelis to continue aligning themselves with countries that are war makers. America has become a war maker. And how is that conducive to peace if, in fact, Israel is looking for peace? How is aligning themselves with war makers going to create more peace for Israel? It is absolutely not in their best interest.
I would just add and say that, you know, we often think of U.S. policy in the region, and I mean, this maybe goes back to the question that was asked earlier about what Americans can do, and although I was pessimistic earlier, I'll give an optimistic note now. But it requires a recheck in a way. And sort of when we talk about American policy in the region, we especially towards this issue, we tend to think of the whole policy. And perhaps that's not necessarily the right way to go. And I'll give an example where perhaps this could be a point of activism and something Americans can do in terms of calling their congresspeople and whatnot and pressuring the candidates and all that. At the November, I mean, I don't buy into the Annapolis process, I don't buy into the peace process and all that, but just for argument's sake, assuming that Congress and the administration do, in November, Israel committed at the Annapolis Conference to reduce the number of checkpoints in the West Bank. It's a very small thing. And if Israel were to do that, if we were to actually implement that policy, it would not mean that peace would break out all over the place. It wouldn't mean that injustice would end. It wouldn't mean really much of anything, except to some extent, lives would be a little bit easier in the West Bank. I think improvement is too big of a word to use. We could just say lives would get a little bit easier. Let's just start small with that. Since November, I just read in The Economist this week, not the most liberal magazine by far, but The Economist this week has calculated that the number of checkpoints in the West Bank has not only has it not decreased since Annapolis, it's actually increased by 10%. Now, this is clearly contrary to Israel's commitments. It's clearly contrary to U.S. policy, which was articulated at Annapolis. It's clearly contrary to any kind of momentum towards moving forward in the peace process. So maybe it's incumbent upon us as pro-Palestinian supporters and whatnot, no matter what our position is on Annapolis, to at least start getting this administration and this government and any administration to start forcing Israel to abide by its commitments that it makes to the United States. Let's remember, it's not that Israel made this commitment to reduce checkpoints to the Palestinian people. It made that commitment to the United States. And that should mean something. And the only way it means something is the United States upholds that commitment, forces that commitment to be upheld in some way. Until now, the U.S. has simply deferred on this. And no matter how many times Condoleezza Rice has gone and had dinner with Ehud Olmert, she has not brought up the issue of the checkpoint. I think it's a small place to start, and it could be something Americans could do. But if we can do it, if we can actually, you know, put pressure and raise questions and force some kind of movement, maybe that could build the momentum from there and to the next step.
Well, I certainly hope so. I admire your fortitude, and I admire your ability to, after seeing all that you have seen in the West Bank, and I know what you have seen because I've been there, to continue your hope, and I think that that is honorable. I think it's glorious, and I hope you and Hawaii continue your work. We are proud to have you as brothers in solidarity and sisters in solidarity, and this is Adam Shapiro, folks, coming to you from the streets of New York City. Tomorrow night we have a special show. Vincent Bugliosi, the famous trial lawyer, will be speaking about prosecuting the Bush administration on June 12th at the People Speak radio show from 7 until 8 p.m. It's a special time, folks, so keep that in mind. It's 7 till 8 p.m. Adam, I appreciate you talking with us. Thank you so much. I love the film. Next time you're in town, you and Huayda, I hope to see you again. I always enjoy seeing you. And I want to thank Miriam, if she's listening, for helping me get your telephone numbers and letting me know that you were in town. I really appreciate it. Good luck with your film and good luck with your work. And free Palestine.
Thank you, Pastor. Free Palestine. Take care.
And again, please remember to look for the Chronicles of the Refugee. That is his latest documentary. Good luck with it, and I will be watching for the next part of it.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Good night, everyone. Thank you for being with us.